Couldn't the Bahamas just let them stay? How was one more Cuban family going to hurt? She looked back at the pier and nice cafe. They had plenty of room. The situation was explained to the tourists on the pier, and they gasped and waited.
All right, Lito said. My daughter is sick. She needs medical attention. No,
Papi said.
You heard him. If we step off this boat, they'll send us back to Cuba. I'm not going back. Then I will go with her, Lito said. I care for Teresa's life more than I care for El Norte.
Tears ran down Isabel's cheeks. No, no. This wasn't the way things were supposed to happen. Her family was supposed to be together. That's why she'd insisted they all go on the boat. And if her mother went back to Cuba and her father went on to the United States, which one was she supposed to go with? Lito started to lift Isabel's mother, but Mommy pushed him away.
No, Isabel's mother said. But Teresa, Lito said. No, I don't want my baby born in Cuba. But you're ill. You can't take another ocean voyage, Lito argued. I will not go back, Mommy said.
She reached up and took her husband's and her daughter's hands.
I will stay with my family.
Relieved, Isabel threw herself into her mother's arms. She was surprised when she felt her father kneel down in the boat and hug them both.
It sounds like we're leaving, then,
Luis told everyone in the boat. Before they could get the engine restarted, one of the tourists tossed down a bottle of water to Señora Castillo. Soon the rest of the tourists were hurrying back and forth to the cafe, buying bottles of water and bags of chips, and tossing them into everyone's hands on the boat.
Aspirin? Does anyone have aspirin? For my mother?
Isabel begged. Up on the dock, an old white woman understood. She quickly dug around in her big purse and tossed a plastic bottle full of pills to Isabel.
Thank you! Thank you!
Isabel cried. Her heart ached with gratitude toward these people. Just a moment's kindness from each of them might mean the difference between death and survival for her mother and everyone else on the little raft. By the time they finally restarted the engine and Amara swung them around to leave, they had more food and water than they had brought with them to begin with. But they were farther away from Florida and freedom than they had ever been before.
Mahmoud, somewhere on the Mediterranean Sea, 2015, 11 days from home.
My baby, Mahmoud's mother wailed. My Hana is gone.
The Mediterranean was still attacking them, wave after wave trying to drown them, and Mahmoud could tell that his mother didn't want to fight anymore. It was all Mahmoud could do to keep her head above the water.
I'm still here, Mahmoud told her. I need you. I gave my baby to a stranger, Mahmoud's mother howled. I don't even know who she was.
She's safe now, Mahmoud told her. Hana is out of the water. She's going to live.
But Mahmoud's mother would not be consoled. She lay back in the water, her face to the sky, and sobbed. The dinghy coming by had re-energized Mahmoud, but he could feel the buzz quickly draining away, replaced by a cold exhaustion that left his arms and legs numb. The sea rolled over him, and he went under again, coming up spluttering. He could not keep himself and his mother afloat. Not for long. They were going to die here. But at least Hana was safe. Yes, he had been the one to convince a stranger to take his little sister away. And yes, his mother might never forgive herself for letting Hana go. But at least neither of them would have to live long with their regret. The rain began again. The awful, pelting, deadening rain. And it felt to Mahmoud like Allah was crying for them, with them. They were drowning in tears. Under the sweeping wash of rain, Mahmoud heard something like a drumbeat. Water on something that was not water. He searched the rising and falling waves until he saw it. the backside of a life jacket still strapped to a man who floated face down in the water. In his mind's eye, Mahmud immediately filled in the drowned man's face with that of his father, and his heart thumped against his own useless life jacket. He flailed in the water, half-swimming, half-towing his mother toward the body. But no, the life vest was blue, and his father's had been orange, like Mahmud's. And this one was a real working life jacket. Mahmud let his mother go for just a moment and wrestled the body over. It was the big man who had sat next to him on the dinghy. His eyes and mouth were open, but there was no life in either one. The man was dead. It wasn't the first dead body Mahmud had seen. Not after 4 years of civil war, with his hometown right in the center of the fighting. A man had been killed right next to him in his family's car, he realized with a start. How long ago had that been? Days? Weeks? It seemed like a lifetime ago. But no matter how many times he saw death, it never stopped being horrifying. Mahmud shuddered and recoiled. But if the man was dead, that meant he didn't need his life jacket. Mahmud fought down his fear and fumbled with the straps on the dead man's life jacket. Mahmud's fingers moved, but he couldn't feel them. His hands were like blocks of ice. He only knew he was touching the straps because he could see it happening. Finally, he got one strap unbuckled and another, and as the body began to shift in the vest, Mahmud realized he was condemning this man to the bottom of the sea. He would never be bathed and wrapped in a kafan, never be mourned by those who loved him, never have his friends and family say prayers over him, never be buried facing Mecca. Mahmud was putting a man in his grave, and he had a duty to him. Mahmud had heard funeral prayers too many times in his short life, most recently for his cousin Saeed, who had died when a barrel bomb exploded. Mahmud quietly recited one now. O God, forgive this man, and have mercy on him, and give him strength and pardon him. Be generous to him, and cause his entrance to be wide, and wash him with water and snow and hail. Cleanse him of his transgressions as white cloth is cleansed of stains. Give him an abode better than his home, and a family better than his family, and a wife better than his wife. Take him into paradise, and protect him from the punishment of the grave and from the punishment of hellfire. When he was finished, Mahmud clicked open the last of the straps, and the man's body rolled out of the vest and down into the murky depths of the Mediterranean Sea.
Here, Mom, put this on, Mahmud said.
It took some time to get her into the life jacket, Mahmud doing most of the work. But at last, it was on her, and Mahmud no longer had to fight to keep her afloat. She lay on her back, eyes closed, muttering about Hana, and Mahmud clung to her life jacket. He still had to kick his legs to not pull them both under, but not nearly so much. He didn't know where they would go or how they would get out of the water. Perhaps in the light of day they would see land and be able to swim for it. In the meantime, they had to survive the night.
Joseph. Just outside Havana Harbor, 1939. 18 days from home.
Help! My dad jumped overboard! Help! Joseph cried.
Far below him, already a couple hundred yards away from the ship, Joseph's father thrashed crazily in the water. He screamed incoherently, but he wasn't calling out for rescue. On the decks below, passengers ran to the rails and pointed. The ship's siren continued to blow, and sailors ran about, but nobody was doing anything. Joseph spun around helplessly. What was he supposed to do? Jump in after his father? It was such a long way down, and he didn't know how to swim. Down below, on C deck, one of the Cuban policemen tossed his cap and gun belt aside, kicked off his shoes, and jumped headlong into the green water. He hit the ocean with a slap and a splash, and for many seconds Joseph held his breath as though he was the diver himself. Joseph's lungs were just about to burst when the man broke the surface a few yards away from where he'd hit, gasping for breath. The man flipped the wet hair out of his face, spun until he had his bearings, and set off swimming for Joseph's father. Joseph's heart raced as fast as his feet as he flew down the stairs. He pushed through the crowds and ran to the rail, but the policeman hadn't yet reached his father. A woman screamed, and Joseph followed the pointing fingers. Two shark fins had appeared in the water. Joseph froze in terror. There were more screams as his papa sank beneath the waves, and Joseph had to cling to the rail not to collapse. One of the St. Louis's lifeboats hit the water, and the ship's siren had brought motor launches from the shore. But none of them were going to be in time. The only person close enough to save Joseph's father was the Cuban policeman. Even though the sharks still circled, the policeman took a deep breath and dived beneath the waves. Joseph counted the long seconds before the man broke the surface again, this time with Papa in his arms. The passengers on the ship cheered, but Joseph's father didn't want to be rescued. He struggled in the man's arms, beating and flailing at him.
"Murderers!" he cried. "They'll never take me!"
But Papa was weak, and the policeman was strong. One of the motor launches from shore reached them first, and the policeman helped the other men lift Joseph's father into the boat.
"Let me die! Let me die!"
Joseph's father cried. The words struck Joseph like slaps to the face, and tears sprang to his eyes. His father would rather die than be with his son, his daughter, his wife. The crack of a pistol shot made Joseph jump. One of the men in the boat stood aiming a gun down into the water near the policeman.
"Pack, pack!"
He shot twice more, and one of the shark fins turned away from the policeman to attack the shark the man had wounded with his pistol. The men laid Joseph's father in the bottom of the boat and helped the weary policeman aboard. There were sighs of relief and whispered prayers on the St. Louis, but Joseph's heart lurched when he saw his father kick away the man trying to help him. Papa lunged for the side of the small boat, trying to get back to the sea.
"Let me die!" he cried out again.
The policeman grabbed him and pulled him back in the boat. Two more of the men restrained him, and the boat quickly turned and sped toward the shore. The St. Louis's siren stopped blasting, and suddenly it was over. All around Joseph, passengers wept. But Joseph now felt more stunned than sad. His father was gone. In many ways, his father had never really come back from the concentration camp. Not the father Joseph knew and remembered. Not the father he loved. He had come back in body, but not in spirit. Joseph's father was gone. His mother was unconscious. His little sister was all by herself. And they would never let Joseph's family into Cuba now. Not after his father had gone mad. Joseph and his family would all be sent back to Germany, back to the Nazis. Joseph's world was falling apart, and he didn't see any way to put it back together again.
Isabel, somewhere between the Bahamas and Florida, 1994. 4 days from home. The little boat was falling apart. The seams between the sides had cracks in them. The engine rattled in its mounting, constantly weakening the bolts that held it in place. Even the benches were coming loose. Only Castro hadn't cracked. He stared up at Isabel as stern and confident as ever, commanding her to fight against the impossible and win. But it was hard to fight against the inevitable. The water in the boat was almost to Isabel's knees. She and the others worked sluggishly in the blazing hot Caribbean sun to scoop, pitch, but water was seeping in as fast as they could bail it. The boat was sinking. Every empty water bottle and gasoline can had been tucked up under a bench to help keep them afloat, but if they didn't reach Florida soon, they were all going to drown. "Fight against the impossible and win," Isabel told herself.
"When are we going to get there?"
Iván whined.
"Mañana," Lito said wearily. "Mañana."
Suddenly, Isabel's grandfather stopped bailing water. He sat up straighter, like he was looking at something in the distance.
Mañana, he whispered.
Lito?
Isabel asked. Her grandfather blinked and his eyes found her again. Was he crying? Or was it just sweat and seawater?
It's nothing, Chabela. Just a memory. Something I haven't thought about in a long time.
Isabel's grandfather gazed around the little boat, and his eyes suddenly looked sadder, Isabel thought. She would have crawled over and hugged him, but there was no room to do it without three people getting up and moving for her to get there.
Don't stop bailing,
Señor Castillo told them from where he lay in the bottom of the boat.
Maybe you could help,
Papi told him.
I'm recovering,
Señor Castillo argued.
I can barely move in this heat. Besides, I don't see you bailing. I'm tending to my wife,
Papi said,
who's really sick.
Ever since the Bahamas, something had come over Isabel's father. He'd been more attentive to Mommy, more focused on her than anything else. Nobody else noticed, but Isabel did. She'd seen him hold her hand, watched him gently move her hair out of her face, heard him whispering that he loved her, that he needed her. Things she had never seen or heard him do before.
Are you saying my father is faking it?
Luis challenged.
I'm just saying it's very nice for him that everybody else is keeping this metal coffin afloat, while he sits back and relaxes,
Papi said.
You wouldn't even have this metal coffin if I hadn't built it.
I'm not sure if built is the right word,
Señora Castillo said, trying to pull two of the side pieces back together.
Cobbled is more like it.
Iván and Señor Castillo erupted at the same time.
We did the best we could,
Iván yelled.
Oh, now you're telling us how to build things?
Señor Castillo said.
Where were you and Luis when we were up all night putting this thing together, eh? You were at your law office, doing God knows what.
Isabel shrank in her seat and put her hands over her ears. She hated when her parents argued like this, and now everyone on the boat was mad at each other.
I was helping people,
Señora Castillo told her husband.
You've never appreciated what I do. And what was I supposed to do?
Luis threw in.
Tell my police commander I had to stay home and build a boat so I could escape? All of you, stop it!
Amara yelled from the back of the boat.
Right now! You're acting like children!
Everyone fell quiet and looked appropriately chastised.
I think it's time for a water break,
Amara told them.
Isabel? Will you hand out the bottles?
It was a little earlier than their rationed water break, but none of them complained. The clear, delicious water was the best thing Isabel had ever tasted, and it settled them all down like mother's milk for a baby.
We're all hot, and we're all tired, and yes, we're sinking,
Amara said.
But if we lose our heads, we're only going to die faster. We can resolve this.
She's right,
Isabel's father said.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry too,
Señor Castillo said.
I should be helping.
Only if you're up to it,
Papi said, and he sounded like he meant it.
The boat is falling apart, though, Iván said. We're taking on too much water. We have too much weight,
Señora Castillo said. She was right, but what could they lose? There was just the engine, the fuel, the food and water, and the nine of them.
What if one or two of us slipped out into the water at a time?
Papi suggested.
They could hang on to the boat. Floating in the water alongside would help take some of the weight away.
But it would drag on the boat, slow us down,
Luis said.
But it might keep the boat afloat longer,
Señor Castillo said.